podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today it is Tuesday, June the 12th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. We have another jam-packed audio stash for you today, folks. We're going to speak with Democratic presidential contender Mike Gravel on the audio stash today. We'll also speak with Paul Armentano, Normal's senior policy analyst, in our Government at Work segment with an update on amendments to Vermont's medical marijuana law. Also today, a special treat in legislators out there, we'll speak with the Canadian Parliament's House Leader for the New Democratic Party, Libby Davies, who represents Vancouver East. Ms. Davies is working hard to combat a conservative drug strategy in Canada modeled after the U.S. All that's here on the Audio Stash today. Let's get right into it with our Government at Work segment. Government at Work, we're going to speak with Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano about amendments to Vermont's medical marijuana law. Paul, welcome back here to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Great to speak with you today, Paul. Now, we've seen a lot of activity in New England this year. Tell us about the developments there in Vermont.
Well, about 10 days ago, I'm pleased to say that Republican Governor Jim Douglas in Vermont allowed Senate Bill 7 to become law without his signature. Certainly, it would have been better had he stood up for the rights of patients and signed this into law, but frankly, the bill now still carries the same weight as it otherwise would. He just simply took the option of not signing it. Either way, come this July, Vermont's three-year-old medical marijuana bill will be expanded, and we think that this expansion will greatly help patients in that state.
And what kinds of amendments were made to the Vermont law?
Well, under Senate Bill 7, there will be several changes to the existing law, and we favor these changes. As many people may know, Vermont in 2004 passed what is arguably the most restrictive medical marijuana law in the country. And as a result, in the 3 years of existence, only about 30 or so patients are registered with the state to legally possess and use marijuana. Now, compare that to the literally hundreds or in some cases thousands of patients registered to use marijuana legally in other states, and one can see that there is a problem that this bill was overly restrictive. One of the major things that Senate Bill 7 does is it expands the definition under Vermont state law of a debilitating medical condition. Under the current law, only patients who are diagnosed with terminal cancer, MS, or HIV/AIDS were allowed to register with the state to possess and use marijuana. Under the amended law, This term, debilitating medical condition, has been expanded to also include any disease that produces severe pain, severe nausea, severe seizures, or severe wasting in patients. And certainly we believe that will allow literally hundreds of additional patients to now apply for this legal state protection. The law also expands the amount of marijuana patients can possess legally under Vermont state law. Under the current law, patients are only allowed to grow up to one mature marijuana plant and have two immature marijuana plants on their premises. They're also allowed to possess up to 2 ounces of marijuana. Under the amended law, patients will now have the option of cultivating up to 2 mature marijuana plants and possessing 7 immature marijuana plants. Once again, these are limits that we feel will be much more in line with patients' actual needs than were under the original legislation.
And Paul, I also understand that these changes in Vermont would allow some doctors in other states, surrounding states, to make that marijuana recommendation and have it work within the law in Vermont.
One of the amendments also under this new legislation is there is language that would allow doctors in some neighboring states, specifically Massachusetts, New York, and New Hampshire, who have a bona fide patient relationship with patients in Vermont to also have the ability to recommend marijuana to them. And that is important in states like Vermont and in these rural areas where patients have to travel quite some distance to see their primary care physicians. Some patients may not have easy access to primary care physicians, and this language considered that fact and tried to work with patients who may have physicians in neighboring states or live on the borders of Vermont and some of these other states.
And are these medical marijuana laws in New England, you know, Rhode Island, Vermont, are they more restrictive in nature overall?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that New England's programs are that restrictive. Vermont's most certainly was, and one of the reasons for that was because in 2004, this was a highly contentious issue among legislators, and a lot of compromises were made along the way to get the initial bill passed. And now, as you see, it took about 3 years for legislative compromises to be made once again, but in this respect to expand the bill to get it much closer to the way proponents would have wanted the original bill to have been written. Rhode Island also has a medical marijuana bill. As many people know, the bill is actually, or the law, I should say, is set to expire at the end of this month, and we are hoping that the legislature overrides a recent governor. We are hoping that the legislature overrides the governor's recent veto to continue this program. But once again, Rhode Island's program, I would not argue, is really any more restrictive than many other state programs, such as, say, Montana's or Oregon's or Washington's. Once again, the law was passed by the legislature, and sometimes when you have that, you inherently get a slightly more restrictive program than a law you would have gotten if it was passed by initiative. Maine's medical marijuana law, which has been on the books now for a good 8 or 9 years, was passed by voter initiative, and it is very similar to the other medical marijuana laws that did pass by voter initiative back in the mid-1990s. And I would not say it's a particularly restrictive program. In fact, unlike many state laws, it does not even require patients to be part of a licensed state registry to receive a state legal exemption to possess and use marijuana.
And though the law is passed and the amendments are made, I know it's also important for politically active individuals in Vermont to stay in contact with their legislators. This is one of those happy circumstances to send along a nice note of praise.
Sure, it's very important. You know, we tell people all the time to write their elected officials when they oppose legislation or when they oppose some of their activities. It's equally important for people to write their legislative officials when they simply want to say thanks. It took a lot of courage for many of these Vermont legislators, particularly the sponsor of this bill, Senator Sears to stick his neck out and move forward with this sort of legislation. And the public in that state really ought to be in touch with their legislators and tell them, hey, you did the right thing. You have my vote for doing so.
Righto, Paul. Well, many thanks again for joining us here today during Government at Work for this update on Vermont.
No problem, Chris.
Paul Armentano is Normal's Senior Policy Analyst. You can contact him with questions or comments via email. Just send an email to paul@normal.org. Today on the Audio Stash, we get a chance to have a conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Mike Gravel. Mr. Gravel served two terms as U.S. Senator from Alaska and has been campaigning hard across the country and in debates for the Democratic nomination for U.S. President. He's the only presidential candidate so far to call for the outright legalization of marijuana. Senator Gravel, welcome here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today.
Well, thank you very much for welcoming me to your stash.
Wonderful to speak with you today, Mr. Gravel. First, let me ask what this experience has been like for you of running for president.
Well, of course, running for president, it's like Jack Kennedy said, running for president is the tough part. Serving is going to be a cakewalk. And with respect to the debates, Clearly, the mainline media, or many of the pundits, view me as the crazy uncle coming out of the attic after so many years out of office. But I look upon more like what Leah Iacocca, the title of his book, you know, where have all the leaders gone? Well, one is coming back, and he's running for president of the United States, and it's me.
Now, you've been very outspoken on the marijuana issue. You made a statement recently that you would favor the legalization of marijuana. Tell me, where does that belief come from?
Well, where does it come from? Because our whole drug policy is insane. You know, if I defy anybody in American culture to not realize that the whole prohibition era was a failure in American democracy and criminalized untold numbers of people and brought about great disrespect for the law. Now, when you have a bad law and people don't obey it, well, it flows over to other areas. So where I come from, it is a realization from day one that the prohibition against marijuana and the problems with hard drugs is not a criminal problem. It's a public health problem, and we have to deal with it as a public health problem. And so here what we've done is we've filled our prisons full of people that shouldn't be there, and we've criminalized a substance that is not nearly as serious as alcohol in terms of addiction. And so people can go buy a fifth of booze and drink it all, and that will do 100 times more damage than marijuana. A similar quantity of marijuana would do. In fact, it's generally known that there are healing properties to the use of marijuana. So, and we spend as a nation anywhere from $50 to $70 billion a year on this whole prohibition of drugs, illegalization of drugs. We not only criminalize a lot of our people, but we destabilize countries like Mexico, Colombia, and Afghanistan, and you know, in our during the Vietnam era, our whole CIA was involved in some of this stuff. It's just pathetic, and what it's the religious right, by and large, that has been pushing this. People like Bennett and others, and they have their addictions. So I just think that somebody in running for president has got to make this an issue so that and I think the American people would buy into it, that we don't need to do this, and we can begin to treat it as a public health problem.
So this is a long-standing position for you regarding marijuana legalization.
I felt this way essentially all of my adult career and have never been in a position to try to offer some leadership in that regard. And now that I'm running for president, because of, for two reasons, one to end the war and the other is to empower people to become lawmakers. And so in this capacity, and this, I just stepped forward in trying to provide some leadership to change the direction of the country in this regard. That the American people are smart enough that if we face up this problem politically and nationally, that they will come down on the right side of this, and the right side being that we should decriminalize totally marijuana, make that as legal as alcohol, and that with respect to the rest of the drugs, that we should legalize their regulation, that then will help. Not only the money will save, we can now spend on helping people get rid of their addiction. But then, but anybody that wants any hard drugs can go to a doctor, register, and then we can begin and then provide them with drugs that they don't have to go to the criminal element in society to get their drugs. So that changes the whole dynamic. It puts the government in the position of trying to help people rather than trying to imprison them. And they come out of prison. We've now taught them how to be criminals. They come out of prison, and then they go commit crimes to sustain their habit. But that's absolutely ridiculous and suicidal from a social, sociological point of view. So that, that's as much as I know on the Alaska side. I do know that there have been some studies that show, and quite lengthy studies, 12 years, where there's been no trace of proving that marijuana, the use of marijuana or cannabis, that would lead to addiction to hard drugs. It's totally here. Drinking four martinis or one martini, whatever, two martini lunch doesn't lead to alcoholism any more than smoking or enjoying marijuana, whether it's in brownies or other forms.
Senator Gravel, you've been outspoken about the Iraq conflict as well, stating that you would immediately bring the troops home. Let me ask, how much do you think prohibition has played into the kind of power taking we've seen in the last 7 years that has created this whole foreign policy situation?
I don't know, and that's a very good question. I do know this, that the interrelationship of issues that limit our freedom, and these have been on the increase, obviously. You know, with the attitude towards war, the fear that's induced by the military-industrial complex for the last 50 years in our society. Because if you can keep society living in fear, you can sell them almost anything for their protection. We see this with the extent, or the overblown extent of Homeland Security. And so fearing drugs, and of course the whole drug program creates criminals. So now you got to fear these criminals that are pushing drugs or on drugs or what have you. And then of course the answer to that is you've got a problem on the streets, so you now got to empty the streets out, put everybody in jail. Here, think of the shame of our democracy that we have more people, 2.3 million people in jail, more than any other country in the world. And we're supposed to be a free country. So no, I think, Chris, it interrelates, and I keep saying this, that what we need is a president that calls upon the courage in all of us. And the reason why I use courage, which is so important, because that's how we can implement the rest of our virtues. Now, FDR, you know, faced a similar problem, very similar. He's the one that ended Prohibition, and also he's the one that called upon the people to put their fear aside. There's no reason to have the amount of fear we have in this country, fear of terrorists, fear of gays, fear of people of color, just fear of immigrants, fear of communists. There's just no end of this. And, of course, their response is, well, we got to do a war on this, war on terrorism, war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan. And now we want to, many of these same people want to do a war in Iran. There's just no end to this whole approach. And so back to your original point, is this all interrelated? I sure think it is.
And Senator Gravel, you talk very strongly about leadership. We don't see our elected officials taking on some of the most important yet controversial topics like prohibition or poverty reduction or even health care outside of some electioneering. Is that something you find pervasive in American politics right now among all the parties?
Yes, it is. And it's difficult, since leaving office, I've really kept myself informed. And I'm a theorist. And so I've developed this legislation to empower the American people by being able to make laws. But I don't have a magic answer for that. I really don't. It's a thoughtful question. I have thought about it extensively, and the only answer that I can come up with, because I come to this conclusion, there's only two venues for possible change. You want to improve our society. You want to improve the nature of representative government. And so how politicians act is really dictated by the way representative government works. And politicians learn early on that if you take on controversial subjects, you're going to alienate one of two parties. And so you learn the art politically of not taking on controversial subjects, which means you don't advance society by providing thoughtful solutions that then can be discussed at length within the polity, but you stay away from that. And so what politicians learn, and this is a bit of a cliche joke, is that, you know, a person who's really commanded the art, and I did in my heyday, my salad days when I was in the Senate, is you can tell people to go to hell and make them look forward to the trip. That's a politician. And so now what we have to do is recognize that it's the structure of representative government that does it. A politician wants to please, generally, they want to serve. And we get a lot of good people to go into politics and public service, and we need a lot more. But what happens is the longer they're there, the more they enjoy the heady wine of power. And power corrupts. It corrupts everybody. And so we have a problem, and that's the reason why I'm so strong on term limits, is that if power corrupts, then we have to limit the amount of time any elected official has it, or a judicial official. I would put term limits on the one term for the president, 12 years for senators, 12 years for House members, but make their terms 4 years rather than two, and then term limits on the entire judicial system, that the including the Supreme Court, 12 years, and you're up and you're out. This way, you turn over the leadership of the country. We'll never get back to what many thought we should have, just citizen elected officials. No, life is too complex now in our society. But what we can do is turn over the number of people that serve and use power, so that you have a continuous influx. What I've noticed as an elected official is that most, and this is what I've observed in the Senate historically and in my own case, most of the people do all of their great work in their first term, first 6 years. I did it in 4 years. And so after that, you're sitting there trying to keep your power. You're careful what you have to say because you're afraid that people will vote against you and so on. And I was not careful. I was a maverick. I just continued, and I don't know why I'm like that. I am. All I got to do is try to see if I can't persuade, at least now in the Democratic race, enough Democrats to get me the primary nomination. And I think I would have an opportunity, and then I'm positive I could eat all of these Republican lunches that are standing up and talking about warmongering, talking about fear. I think the American people are ready for a new dialogue in that regard. Now, will I get elected? It all depends on the people. I've made a calculation. One I'd like to be president. I think I could do an unbelievable job there. But I also think it's more important to have the people empower themselves than just empower Mike Gravel, to empower themselves to make laws, because I'll be long gone, and that power will really operate to the benefit of our society.
Well, Senator Gravel, this has been a great conversation here today. I cannot thank you enough for taking time to join us here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash today.
Well, Chris, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much again. Senator Mike Gravel is running for the Democratic nomination for U.S. President. We have links to his website on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Next up on the Audio Stash today, we get a rare chance to speak with an elected official from Canada's National Parliament. Libby Davies is the House Leader for the NDP, or the New Democratic Party of Canada. She represents Vancouver East in Parliament. Libby, welcome here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash today.
I'm pleased to be there.
It's
well, on the phone anyway.
It's great to speak with you today, Libby. You know, I saw your debate in the House of Commons there regarding the new drug strategy proposed by the Conservative government in Canada. Let me ask what your thoughts are on this drug strategy and what you think of the U.S. approach of prohibition.
Well, I mean, our big concern here is that with a new Conservative government that was elected in January 2006, that they're about to turn the clock back and move much, much closer to to George Bush's drug strategy, failed drug strategy. Canada has had fairly successful programs. Very slowly, we've been pushing governments to adopt what we call the four pillars approach. And in fact, I'm very involved with people who are sort of trying to take on prohibition as a whole. And so we've made a lot of progress. But with the new Conservative government that we have, there's no question that they are ideologically opposed to harm reduction. They're opposed to safe injection sites. They're opposed to any measure that is apparently beyond sort of further criminalization and enforcement regime. So we're actually very, very worried. We're expecting a slew of bills to come through that focus on, quote, enforcement. We've already seen in the last budget that just came out in March that we're now debating actually, that they already have moved harm reduction as one of the pillars. And although they say they're putting some money into prevention and treatment, it's a very minimal amount. So there, you know, Mr. Harper's focus is on an enforcement strategy, the criminalization of users, you know, focusing much greater capacity on enforcement, which, of course, we know from what's happened in the United States has been an abysmal failure. I mean, basically, the war on drugs is a war on poor people.
Indeed. Also, you say this strategy is a, quote, carbon copy, close quote, of George W. Bush's prohibition strategy. You know, how much does the U.S. position and politics affect the Canadian side of this issue?
Well, I think it's having an increasing influence. We've seen the drug czar come up to Canada repeatedly. He did under the previous administration or government here as well. But I think Mr. Walters is finding, you know, that the Conservatives are listening to what he's saying. And there's just no question that Stephen Harper is very close to George Bush on a whole number of issues, whether it's missile defense, environment, not meeting Kyoto, and certainly on crime and drug issues. So, I mean, that's very troubling for us because many of us here in Canada, a lot of the advocacy groups and various organizations, we've tried to really promote policies that would take us much closer to the European model because, not only because we think they're better policies, but also because we understand how important it is, because we are, you know, friends and allies with the United States, that it's very important that here in Canada we could show that there's a different kind of regime that isn't about, you know, the absurd penalization of drug users and the criminalization of people, whether it's for marijuana or any other drugs, that we could show that there's another way of developing public policy that focuses on harm reduction, that focuses on proper education, and where necessary, treatment, that would counter what's going on in the U.S.
Libby, you mentioned John Walters. One of his favorite phrases, it seems, is the phrase BC Bud. But British Columbia and Vancouver in particular are growing a lot more than good marijuana. This area seems to be growing a much more progressive policy and approach to the idea of marijuana and other substances in society.
Well, there's a very strong movement in BC, in Vancouver particularly, that involves users, whether it's marijuana users or other drug users. It involves academics, it involves health officials, elected officials, even across the political spectrum, where we've gone, you know, far beyond even calling for harm reduction. We now are tackling prohibition itself as an incredibly harmful policy. And that debate in Vancouver and that movement of these very diverse interests coming together is very strong. I don't know if I'd say I'm optimistic, but I think at least in BC, and there are sort of other voices across the country, there'll be a very strong pushback on what the Conservative government in Canada is trying to do here. We're in the process of, you know, alerting people. I'm going to go out across the country in the summer and do some speaking to alert different communities to what's going on. But in BC, I mean, that's where the real strength is, I believe. And it's really quite incredible because it does cross sort of the spectrum. And it's a very healthy debate that goes on. And there's a very strong sense that, you know, we have to actually tackle prohibition and look at drug policy reform in a much more serious way. So that will continue. But at the same time, we're going to be fighting some of these measures that come forward. And, you know, if, for example, in my riding, or what you would call a district, we have the safe injection site called InSight. I mean, that's a very important measure that's actually saving lives. It's the first safe injection site in North America. And I can tell you, people will defend that with everything they've got, me included. We're not going to let that one go. And it's going to become, I think, the symbol of the struggle that's taking place around drug policy in Canada.
We spoke a moment ago about the U.S. influence on Canadian policy, but, you know, what about vice versa? Is there some Canadian influence on some American policy, perhaps for the better here?
I've participated in meetings, for example, where we've had LEAP, the law enforcement against prohibition. We've even had, other advocates. We're even up and down the West Coast, because I think that's, I mean, I'm actually very interested to promote that kind of dialogue and solidarity, because we are the focus of drugs coming in. We're the focus of a lot of interdiction that, you know, again, has been a failure. So I know, for example, like King County in Washington State has done some very fine work around prohibition, ending prohibition. And so there is, I mean, it's not enough. I mean, I would love it to be a lot more, but there is sort of good contact networking going on. And again, I think that up until now, some of our American friends have seen Canada as sort of a, you know, maybe a light at the end of the tunnel, that progressive things were being done here. And and again, this is why I think it's been so important for Canada to take this sort of alternative route rather than the war on drugs, because it has helped provide, you know, a solid, concrete evidence that these measures are working. So we have to keep that going. I mean, I think there's been very positive influences, but clearly, you know, we're also shaping up for a battle here, and I think we're going to need to really make sure that people are working together very closely, because I really believe that the public is also light years ahead of where some of these very conservative politicians are. I mean, most people in my district and in Vancouver understand the abysmal failure of the war on drugs. And they've gotten to the point where they understand of, you know, playing the politics of fear and just saying, well, you know, there's crime, there's disorder on the streets. They understand that just bringing in more cops or bringing in tougher criminal sanctions is not going to deal with this issue. And I think there's a lot of people that understand that. But it is, again, about, you know, encouraging and promoting further awareness and education. And I do want to say that I think users are very critical to that process. I know in Vancouver, when drug users who so often have been marginalized, particularly, you know, sort of hardcore chronic users, this is going beyond marijuana now, when they speak out and you know, because there's demonization of drug users, right? Mm-hmm. It's the oldest trick in the book for politicians to vilify and demonize drug users, whether they're smoking marijuana or whatever it is. And so what we've witnessed is that when drug users themselves are organized and begin to speak out, groups like VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, it really changes the debate. And it becomes much harder then for politicians to vilify people that suddenly you're hearing about their story, you're hearing about what their life is about. And so that's been a very important element too.
Well, Libby, this has been an absolutely wonderful discussion here today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us, and I hope you'll join us again here on the Audio Stash in the future.
Certainly.
Thank you again, Libby. Libby Davies is a member of Parliament representing Vancouver East in Canada. She's the House Leader for the New Democratic Party of Canada. We have links to her website at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow.